Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, Slackers. I hope you're all good. Hope you're all well. Hope you're enjoying the summer and that you are leaving the house and getting out there and doing some stuff and breathing some fresh air. I know I have. My missus like forced me to like leave the house after like 4 months, so I might actually have some vitamin D in me now. I hope you've been enjoying Slacker season 4 so far. I genuinely think that this is like the strongest season of Slacker that I've done. I mean, nobody wants to be working backwards or anything, but like I've had a lot more time to prepare this than others. And we still have podcasts to come up from KSI, Phineas, Sleaford Mods, Bob Geldof, Haim, Leanne LaHavas, Alan McGee, MJ Cole, Andrew Shikari, Idol, Sean Paul, Jarvis Cocker. Yeah, they're all still to come. So if you have just joined us for this Johnny Burrell podcast and you've never listened to any of them before, then subscribe. So when they say the Jarvis Cocker one drops, you'll have it in your inbox immediately. Also, if you've just sort of jumped on this podcast and go back and listen to some of the episodes that we've done before, you would probably like the Pete Doherty episode. He talks about Johnny Burrell in it. The Pete Doherty episode is probably one of the most listened to on all seasons of the Slacker podcast as well. So there is tons, like 40 or whatever, for you to go back and flick through at your own desire. Big up, mad love to everybody who is supporting the Slacker podcast on Patreon. They went to patreon.com/slackerpodcast and they are contributing to the making of the podcast. You know, it's the same sort of vibe as pretty much everybody else. With the way things are, I've had pretty much most of my work, bar one, like cancelled. So it's given me this opportunity to make loads of content, like make lots of Slacker podcasts. The new Slacker podcast as well, the Slacker Friends podcast, which just comes out on a Friday every week. So that's two podcasts a week, as well as some Slacker videos on YouTube and stuff like that. But I mean, I am making this all for free at the minute. So if you do enjoy the content and you want to be an absolutely sound fucker, then go over to the Patreon. There's loads of exclusives we put up there. Put up an exclusive podcast for Patreon listeners only. There's like playlists. There's tons of stuff up there. So yeah, patreon.com/slackerpodcast. What else is there to tell you about? Are you enjoying the Slacker Friends format that we're doing? Basically, the other podcast that you'll see on the RSS feed, if you're not aware already, it's basically like a music panel show, and there is no music panel shows that I can think of. Maybe the Steve Lomax Roundtable on Six Music, but even that's like more of a review show. This is kind of like a panel show of like what's happened in the week of music, some stupid questions, some serious questions, and yeah, it's all based around what's happening in music. I think it like in terms of like entertainment, music is definitely less catered for, especially in panel shows anyway. But yeah, check out Slack of Friends as well. This podcast that we have today with Johnny Burrell is pretty explosive. Like, I've never met the man before, but obviously grew up listening to his records, owning his records. And yeah, he's like on no other that I've met before. I very much enjoyed my time and company with him, and it took a little while for him to warm up to me, I think, but he definitely did. He definitely did. I think his problems with smartphones was part of that, as you will hear in the podcast. But he was a total diamond geezer, and he was very forthcoming with lots of stories, and he had lots of interesting anecdotes from back in the day, and also what's coming up with Razorlight as well. So pick up Johnny Burrell. Here he is on the Slacker podcast in 3, 2, 1.
It's been quite a cute, confusing experience for me trying to talk to you.
Yeah, that's a little bit, but fuck it, man. It's
I don't have an iPhone. I never use them, so it actually feels like quite a strange thing in my hand right now. I feel like I'm getting the Apple waves that I don't want.
Well, it'll only be an hour. You'll have to flush it out after.
Yeah. It's really weird where it comes up with the video.
Yeah.
Like, you're suddenly on the screen. That's terrifying.
Is this the first time that you've, like, have you not had a smartphone before, or have you been always off
this? This is not my phone. I don't have a smartphone. I wouldn't have one.
Why not? You just, like, not a fan?
I think tech companies are pretty evil, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's all about, it's about advertising revenue, isn't it? I've never had a Facebook, I've never had an Instagram, and I've never had a smartphone, and I just can't see the appeal.
I mean, like, that sounds like something that, like, if I did that, it would take me about a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks to get used to it, and then after a while I would just automatically be pulled back into it. Like, I don't think there's ever been a moment since I was probably about 13 that I haven't been online or looking into some sort of screen of some description.
Yeah, it's very dangerous, you know. I think pretty much every, you know, awareness is the key thing, you know, for humans. And all these things are pretty much designed to diminish your awareness of the outside world, and get you hooked on the device or the medium itself.
Do you ever feel you're missing out on, like, Instagram or something that somebody's talked about on Twitter? Do you get that, or are you just
feel like I'm missing out on Instagram? Is that a serious question?
It's not really, but, like, I mean, when you've got, like, loads of people talking about, like, various different things, do you feel like going, oh, like, you haven't even toyed with the idea, have you?
It just seems like so unappealing to me. It's not like there's part of me that would like to, but I'm like holding back for some kind of moralistic reason. I don't get the appeal.
Yeah.
And it's hard to express, like, because, you know, smartphones have been around for 15, 16 years now. It's hard to express actually the perspective of somebody that's never had one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they've really changed everybody's brains and how people operate. And you actually see that if you haven't been part of it. It's really terrifying, and I don't think it's good. I think there's gonna be lots of people in 20 years writing op eds in things going, what, you know, shit, what happened to my life? Why was I addicted to this little machine?
Do you miss out on it in terms of, like, just like promotion for music? Because, I mean, like, that's where it's kind of all gone with, like, things like, God, like, all the magazines dying away. Yeah, like, less.
I mean, probably. You know, I mean, look, when Facebook came out, we were sort of one of the biggest bands in the country. So, you know, I was very well placed to build a social media empire,
yeah,
or whatever it was, you know. And they came to me and they said, this is what this is. This is Facebook and MySpace or whatever. Do you want to do this? And I thought that's total anathema to what music should be about. Uh-huh. And I'd write, no, absolutely no way. So we just always refused to do it, you know.
Well, thank you for coming on the podcast. Yeah,
it's a pleasure.
Yeah,
it's a pleasure. I'm still feeling a little bit freaked out by my because the other thing was Zoom yesterday, so I'm still feeling a bit freaked out by the medium. I like it. I'm, you know, I like a phone call.
Yeah, like I but at the same time, I'm taking a sick pleasure in knowing that you're using an iPhone now for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for coming on, and thanks for sending me a demo. So like all of the podcasts we've ever done, we've had some incredible artists come on and play like really early demos of their music. And we start them all the same way. And here is yours.
What is the wind? It sweeps away our sins. Yours is the night, just fill it with light. You say, I got a feeling it's just around the bend. Well, I got a feeling that I will fall into the path of L-O-V-E. See you later. Warm is the light. Don't it get you tight? Mine is the night. The shoes through your bed. You say, I got a feeling that it's just around the bend. It's coming. Well, I got a feeling that I will fall into the path of L-O-V. See you later. L-O-V. See you later. To fire our heads. You say, I got a feeling that it's just around the bend. Well, I got a feeling that I will fall into the path of L-O-V-E. See you later. L-O-V-E.
My manager had lent me his apartment, and it was over Christmas, and I was there and I was just writing, and I really enjoyed that particular demo, I think, because it was like, I just don't, you know how hard it is to make something sound good on a cassette four track, you know, and there it was, and it was coming back at me, and I was like, yeah, it just sounds like a song. And I knew that I'd had the band was up and running, because we'd already written about half of the first album, so I knew I had this great band that could do justice to it. And and it was a funny time, and that whole little period, that one, there's one cassette I have from the four track there, where I wrote about three or four songs that all ended up on the Raise Light album, and you can just hear them, you know, and it's just like I must have been on a real roll at that point in time, you know, and so yeah, I was just very grateful to the songwriting force coming through me at that point, you know, because I never feel like it's me that's done it; it just happens.
You know? I hear that from people. Creativity like sort of just beams itself into you. Like it's not like you force it; it just happens through you.
Yeah, totally.
How long before Razor Light started did you write that, or was that song written like, you know, when you were sort of in the thick of it?
I think that was, I think we, I'd formed a band, yeah. I think that was the second wave of material, yeah. So I think we'd, I think we'd started playing and yeah, I was writing, yeah, so.
What, how come like that was like the one that you wanted to go for? Like when there's so many other tracks, like was that like a demo that was quite special to you?
Yeah, I don't know. I thought maybe you'd like to hear something like from, you know, from the writing process,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's always interesting, particularly that song, like, you know, we brought it in like, you know, it changed quite a bit as we played it, as we found the arrangement for it musically, you know. With the band, I mean, do you know the song, the actual song?
Yeah. Like, I mean, like I've got, I mean, like you were pretty much, I was pretty much perfect age for Razorlight and the Libertines in that whole time, because I think, what was I, like 14, 15 when you guys were like really, when Up All Night came out, I was about 14. And I mean, that album was ubiquitous. Like every single one of my mates had that record. And the next one, it seemed to be like you weren't an indie fan unless you had the Razorlight album. Everybody seemed to have the Zootons album.
And good band.
Yeah,
man.
Very good band.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Maybe because we're Northern Irish, everybody seemed to have a copy of 1977 by Ash as well.
Well, yeah, and that's also really, really got some bangers on it.
Yeah,
I only realized that. Ash, that was something I only realized like a little bit later on, because I can't. Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't sure. I was never sure about Ash. And then we were just setting up the mixing desk at the Ali Pali the first time we played it, and I remember our sound man Laurie. He used to tour with Ash, and he put on one of the tracks, you know, to get the levels on the desk, and it just sounded so good. I was like, "Fuck yeah!" So I had a moment of conversion in an empty venue.
that's what takes it. I mean, like when it comes to like 2 minute, 2.5 minute bangers, Northern Ireland generally are quite good at it. Undertones,
yeah, there's definitely heritage, yeah, for sure,
big time. But like even like up until today, I was coming back from getting my little pup vaccinated at the vets, and they had Golden Touch on the radio, and I was thinking to myself when I was driving back, I was going back through the bands that like were really formative for me at that age and really sort of deep into that sort of UK indie guitar scene around that time, and I was like, you probably had the most hits out of everybody, because a lot of them have had a lot of like kudos and maybe a lot of sort of column inches in NME and plays by Zane Lowe and the like of it, but you guys were really the ones that actually had hit records, like, you know, like high charting albums.
Dangerous thing to do.
Yeah. You like did you find that like you got the respect for that, or did you like fly too close to the sun?
Bit of both.
Yeah,
probably a bit of both. You know, I mean, like, yeah, you know, I just really like singles, you know. I kind of always have, you know. And I mean, I really like Up All Night. I really enjoyed making that record, and I think it sits together well as an album, you know. But what I mean by that is most of the songs segue into each other, so it gives the appearance of a cohesive album. And I don't know, man. You know, I don't know.
Just big hit records, like, and the public really.
I thought something like Vice is interesting, right? Because, you know, that was, I don't know where it charted. It was in the top 20 and it was played all over the radio and stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just a straight up rock and roll song.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? There's no, you know, it's not particularly pop, you know, in any way. You know, it's kind of, you know, it probably is in a kind of Ramonesy kind of way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, oh, Springsteen-y, I guess. But like, I mean, we were trying to, I mean, you can hear from the demo, you can hear the song, and then, you know, once it came into the band, it was kind of like, it sort of, you know, it's, everyone's different influences came in. So, you know, it kind of, it's got that kind of Pixies-ish kind of intro, and which, well, we were probably trying to sound like the Pixies, but came out sounding more like Springsteen, actually. you know, it was kind of like, it was, but you know, I do think that's, you know, seeing as we've already talking about the past, it does feel like, you know, that kind of thing, if you release that today, it would be considered far too left field for, you know, for commercial radio in this country, and even more so around the rest of the world, you know.
It is a little bit heartbreaking that, because the thing is, like, you do see a lot of people coming out, like your Noel Gallagher's or your Serge from Kasabian's, and saying there's no, like, good bands around. Actually, not Serge from Kasabian, sorry. Saying that there's not any good rock and roll bands around. I think that's tosh. Like, I think there's absolutely loads of great rock and roll bands around right now, but there's just not really the cultural appetite for it the same way as there has been in the past.
Yeah, I'd half agree with you on that. Where, I mean, I think that yeah, there's talent there, and, you know, but I think that I would agree with you that the talent in terms of rock and roll bands are not necessarily making it through to the mainstream in any way.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's because the cultural appetite isn't there. I think that's because, you know, the radio stations tend to program by focus groups, and, you know, rather than DJs choosing what they want to play, and I'm talking in the mainstream.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? So, you know, and I think that's disgusting. And I think that's something that's happened, you know, where British radio has become a lot more like American radio in that regard, you know, and it's become more commercial and more corporate.
I think it's with, normally you can judge it by like what kids are listening to, and I think kids are, there's a definite thing from record labels, from radio stations and various sort of conglomerates, that they think that young people only want to listen to hip hop, or young people only want to listen to dance. But, like, I, you know, I've been running a record label and working with teenagers for, since I was one, and the appetite isn't tribal anymore. It's not just we want to listen to hip hop, we want to listen to, like, kids now want to listen to indie, hip-hop, techno, house. They don't have to have the one haircut or the Fred Perry t-shirt. They can have the Wu-Tang hoodie, and they can have the drainpipe jeans, you know?
Which is a really interesting cultural development in itself, actually.
Yeah.
If you think before, you know, before the noughties, I mean, you know, going back when I talked to people who were around in the 80s and stuff like that, and it's like, well, that was the most important part.
Yeah,
you know, if you tried to go into a club that was playing whatever it was, you know, neo-romantic stuff, and you weren't a neo-romantic, they just wouldn't let you in. So, you know, or if you wanted to go to the goth club, they wouldn't let you in. Yeah. We still had that a bit in the noughties, a bit in the 90s, you know, but it was, and I think that was, that's something that has definitely changed, and I'm probably not qualified to comment on it. You know,
no,
but that it definitely has changed.
Well,
you know, I do see that, but I think, picking up on your point, I think kids do have an appetite for you know, guitar music and bands making real music, but, you know, it's I don't know. Well, you know, then why doesn't it get played? Also, you've got to look at record companies. You know, it costs a lot more to make music that's played by humans rather than by, you know, programmed, and it costs a lot more to tour it. So I just don't think that people are supporting young bands in the way they were, say, 15, 20 years ago.
I mean, I 100% agree. I run a small DIY label, and it's very hand to mouth, and I've like put out people like Rat Boy, and I've got like a little punk band on there at the minute, and yeah, I know. Yeah, it's, and I've played in bands for 10 years when I was a kid myself. Like, so, it always felt really horrible at the end of the night. The DJ that was playing after you was getting paid £100, and there was four of you bringing all of your gear down, and you were getting paid 30, and you're like, "What the fuck? He's not even playing his own songs."
Well, yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean that doesn't go away because I mean even when you're you know, playing near the top of the bill on festivals, you get the same thing. Do you know what I mean? The guy comes on DJing after you, and he's, you know, and you're thinking the same thing. Yeah. The thing that's happened in recent times is that used to be the case to an extent with music festivals and stuff like that. But now it's like you go and do festivals now, and it's not like one or two of the artists are like singing, or somebody up there is just singing and dancing to a backing track. It's like 9 out of 10 of the artists are doing that.
And that kind of kills the organic sort of nature of rock and roll, I think.
I mean, look, to me, it's my life, so it's something I care really strongly about.
Of course,
I don't watch bands that use backing tracks. I don't watch acts that use backing tracks. I just don't. I mean, certainly not. Like, the worst one for me is if they're pretending to do rock and roll. You know?
What do you mean? Like in terms of what?
Well, like so many, you know, so many bands as they get bigger or whatever, the drummer has got a click track in his ear and he's playing along to the click track. And suddenly when the two guys go to the microphone, you hear four harmonies being sung. And well, because they're playing along to the backing track. So each musician is playing, but there's a whole load of extra parts being played in the background. Now, that used to just happen with Coldplay, U2, that kind of thing, right?
Uh-huh.
With really, really big bands. The Stones, no. You know, the old school bands, no. But the more new school bands, yes. But, like, that's one thing if you're playing an arena. What I noticed, last time I was in New York, young bands, you know, where they're just playing to, like, a small thing, you know, like 100 people, 50 people.
Uh-huh.
I remember I was hanging out with this band and they were saying, oh, well, we've got the labels coming down tonight, so we've got to make it really good. So we're going to use the backing track, you know, so that way we've got our whole sound. So yes, everyone on stage is playing, but they're playing along to a backing track. Now, if that's what people are thinking they need to do, it's a little bit like the relationship people have with their image now, where they think they need to look super cute all the time or whatever it is, and they're always taking photos of themselves to check, right? It's hyper-managing to the point that what's good is no longer there, you know.
But would you not be completely on top of your image? Like, you're always wearing nice clothes, and you know, there's lots of an incredible amount of great photos of you on various magazines. Like, and there has been throughout your career. Like,
oh yeah, but I mean, thanks for giving me the chance to explain that one, because what I mean is, I've seen people in bands, in younger bands, get off stage, go straight to the dressing room, go straight to their phone and look at pictures of the gig and work out which one they're going to post.
Yeah.
Now, that's what I mean by micromanaging. I mean looking back at it. Uh-huh. Now, yeah, maybe a lot of people have taken my photo. Some photographers turn around and they say, do you want to have a look? And I go, no, thanks. I know what I look like. I don't need to see that, you know.
Yeah.
And I go off and do my thing. Do you know what I mean? So what I'm talking about is that micro management of image, where you are the one that's taking the photo of yourself, or if not, you are the one that's editing it and choosing to present it. You know,
it's complete stress, like, because I think like with an artist that's starting out now, the idea is that you kind of have to be the musician, the image, the social media brand. You need to be the website designer. I think there's so much.
Well, most of it's coming back to social media and smartphones. Most musicians I know spend more hours per day on Instagram than they do playing their instrument.
I mean, that's probably fact.
That's of any age.
Yeah.
You know, that's musicians of my age as well who have Instagram. I mean, sorry, like, what the fuck is that?
It does impede with the craft, doesn't it? Like, I mean, if you want to continue getting better...
I mean, if you're a painter and you spend 3 hours, 4 hours a day on Instagram, you know, and 2 hours a day with your brushes, or, you know, it's no good.
Yeah. How much did you, because like I want to sort of get back to like when you learned guitar for the first time, and I've seen a bit where you wrote your first.
Oh, can I just finish that point about music?
Of course,
I feel like I'm a bit dangling because we got into image.
Absolutely.
What I was saying was that I don't go to shows, or I won't stick around at shows where people are using backing track. I just walk out, because to me it's so disappointing. Because the point of live music for me, and this may be different for other people, is that the musicians are on stage. There's a silence between them. that they create in. And what they create is going to be different every night. You know, we've never even used a click track on stage, you know, like a lot of bands do. I would never do that, because every time you perform the song, you should be opening yourselves up to that song becoming whatever it's going to become that night. And every good band should improvise, and every band should be good enough to improvise. And, you know, it's just like so disappointing, you know, to me, if I go and watch a band and that's what's going on. I mean, yeah, I might really like the singer or whatever, or, you know, the guitar player, and I want to see them live, and I get that buzz. But on a musical level, I think that the way the technology's gone, I think it's just dumbing everything down unbelievably. And then as for other styles of music, like you mentioned, hip hop and stuff like that, of course it's programmed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, if the MC is really good, then great, you know, then it works. But hip hop was designed as that, you know? So for me, I just think there's, I don't know, man, you know, if the actual thing, I don't know, you know, it's like, you know, 20 years ago, you're going to see the biggest sort of acts, you know, you're going to see a Michael Jackson or a Prince or whatever. And, you know, they'd have the best pop songs. They'd also have the best musicians. They'd also have the best dance moves. And that would be the whole package, you know. And now you're going to see the biggest pop acts. And, all right, they might have the biggest songs, and they might have some dance moves, usually danced by their dancers. And they're singing to a backing track.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a joke.
But it's, you know, it goes back to craft.
Completely, yeah. And it's dumbed down so much, you know. And anyway, I remember seeing Elton John at the Q Awards in 2004. We were there to win the Best New Act, Raise Light, and one of our very few awards. And Elton John got up, and they'd given Best Live Thing to Madonna or something like that. And he said exactly the same thing that I just said. There was a big panic silence in the room.
I actually think I remember that. Yeah, that was an amazing moment.
And then I had this great idea that I thought, because everything was clearly going so well for me in my life, I thought that I could, in front of everybody, you know, Elton John, everybody, and Madonna, whoever, everyone in the whole fucking stratosphere of popular music.
Yeah.
I thought that I'd be able to do that trick where you pull the tablecloth but don't disturb any of the things that are on top of it, you know, the glasses,
yeah,
the plates and stuff, and just yank it off as I walked out.
Yeah. was that
you can imagine how that ended.
Was that your like a sort of attempt at a mic drop, really, like a, you know, it was just like, this is my full stop, evening over.
I just saw it, and suddenly, you know, like, do you play football or anything? I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, do you know, like, suddenly you can just score that goal. You know that you've got that split second to do it.
Yeah.
And sometimes from the moment it leaves your foot, you know it's a goal, and sometimes you know you've shanked it sorely wide.
Who did you spill it over? Like, who was at your table? Was it your other bandmates, or were you sharing a table?
Oh, no, it wasn't my table. We were on our way out.
Oh, fuck, that's even worse.
It was somebody else's table.
Like the,
I don't think there was anyone sitting in it either. I think people were like, oh, I don't know. Anyway,
were you at the NME Awards when the was it Ryan Jarman jumped over the table and managed to pierce himself on a bottle while he was doing it and almost died?
No, I wasn't. If I was, I was doing something else. Yeah. I don't think I was.
Yeah, like that's like, it's up there, like that Ryan Jarman moment's up there with Jarvis Cocker mooning and Michael Jackson. And
that was quite amazing, wasn't it?
That was a cultural moment. Like, that was like the first time I remember watching the Brits.
Yeah, I mean, it made the Brits almost, it was like the only watchable bit in the history of the Brits.
I do miss those moments. I do, like, I only watch the Brits because I hope that something like absolutely insane happens. Like, the last thing I remember is watching Arctic Monkeys go up and receive their awards, and Alex Turner looked very animated, and then dropped the mic.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I was at a Brit Awards once. They've kind of like, this was how, you know, this is the annoying side of the music industry, because they'd be like, obviously somehow they'd send an invite to the Brit Awards to my label or whatever, and I'd be like, and whatever, I wouldn't know anything about it, and then they'd say, oh, by the way, you've been invited to the Brit Awards, and I go, okay, great, well, I've got no interest in going whatsoever, because It's just not, I don't really like award ceremonies. I don't really think that music should go through that kind of,
pageantry, yeah.
Call it pantomime, uh-huh. And I just think I'm just opposed to it completely, you know. And then the label will turn around and say, oh, but we already accepted your invitation. So, you know, if you don't go, it'll look really bad. And you're like, oh, right, okay, brilliant. You know, so you're there kind of thinking like, all right, well, shit, I guess, you know, if I don't go, it's going to be like, you know, it'll probably be in the newspapers, you know, that like I've thrown some tantrum to not attend the Brit Awards or something. Thank you very much. And all, you know, and you're kind of like there just going, all I ever did from the start was just say to them, by the way, I don't want to go to any award ceremonies.
It's crazy how they can cut paste and twist. But like, I mean, when you're in the public eye as much as kind of you are, then it's an easy byline, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah. But it was, that was challenging. I mean, I'm philosophical about it now, but you know, when you're 24 years old and you find that someone's accepted an invitation on your behalf to something that you'd rather fucking poke your own eye out than go to, you know, and yeah. If you don't go, you're going to look like a cunt. It's kind of like, it's a bit of a, what's the phrase? Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
I wanted to go back to the first track that ever like inspired you to sort of go down the musician path, or not even the musician path, but just the first sort of real love of music, like the first eureka moment where you heard a piece of music and you thought this is me.
Well, I don't know, man, because I just always loved music, and I loved the fact that people were talking through their songs. You know, uh-huh. That was magic to me. You know, it was just such unbelievable magic that it was nice to listen to, but somebody was actually saying words and talking to somebody somewhere, you know, in this form of communication that was kind of more true than just talking, you know. I don't know how, it just kind of, you know, seemed to me instinctively more true than anything.
Does that mean you connect better with the lyrics or the melody? Because it's hard to like have a 50-50 balance on both. Like I'm 100%, like I'm a massive melody guy, and then lyrics are after fact. But like you wrote poetry and stuff when you were younger before writing music as well. So where do you stand with that?
No, I don't know, because for me, it's like, I don't know, man, you know, like there's different kinds of songs, you know. There's always like, there's like the singer's nightmare, which is when like the guitarist has got a great riff and you know it's a great riff and everyone's playing and it's like, fucking hell, this is brilliant. And then like, you're like, oh my God, no, I bet this is what Robert Plant was going through on Led Zeppelin 3. Like, what the fuck am I going to sing about? Yeah. Right, as long as I don't sing about Gollum, right, it's going to be okay.
Yeah, exactly. Lord of the Rings, I mean, it works.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think he's a bit embarrassed about those ones. So, you know, and you're kind of like, well, all right, so as long as I don't go there, you know, as long as I don't sort of think like, okay, so there's very few of those in one or two, but generally, some, I don't know, generally when I write songs, I write and write and are kind of good, you know, but not, I don't know, they just don't feel like a complete song. You know, most songs, they come when I've been writing lots of other songs, and then if I know what the first line is and I know who I'm talking to, then the song just writes itself, you know, because all I'm doing is I'm just talking into the ear of my friend.
I feel quite like that with when I, the way I approach radio, it's a one-on-one, and with music, with the way you write music, obviously it gets heard by a lot of people, and you know,
it's very dangerous for a band, I think, because by the time, I mean, like, it's interesting. I was going through some demos the other day, like, you know, coronavirus, I've got a box full of cassettes. So I was like, okay, let's go through some of these. And it's really interesting. I was listening to like our demos of like coming into the second album and then coming into our third album. And I mean, coming to the second album, we'd already like, you know, we'd sold 1.5 million records, and Golden Touch had been a big hit and Somewhere Else and stuff. So, you know, our lives had changed, you know, completely. Mm-hmm. But I think we were still writing for ourselves. We just felt incredibly relaxed, you know, and like just having fun. And then I was listening to the third one, and by then we'd sold like a lot of records and played huge shows and played headline festivals and done the whole thing, world tours and all that kind of stuff. So things had really, really, really changed. And I listened to the demos, and it was really weird because it was really stiff, because it was almost like we were supposed to know what we were doing. And it sounded like we were trying to be professional, like, okay, like almost like someone's got a clipboard, like, okay, now we're going to do that song, and then we're going to do that song, which is just like, you know. And then, because I think by then, as soon as you start thinking, you're thinking about the audience, and like, you know, so instead of just talking into the ear of your friend, you're trying to talk to everybody at once, and that just doesn't work, you know. And then weirdly, on that third album, which, you know, was an album I kind of like, I wasn't in the headspace to make, and I think was... that's a whole other story, but you know, there was a song called Wire to Wire that ended up being like a huge hit in Germany and places in Europe, bizarrely. And you know, that was one of the only songs on the album where I was just singing into the ear of a friend, you know, and I never thought it would be a single or anything like that, you know. The other thing, sorry, I was going to say was that all my hits have been demos.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Or at least, you know, have the recordings have been 50% the demo, you know.
So, like, does that mean when you take it into the band or you take it into a producer, that you can tinker with it too much?
We've tried to re-record. It means that I've written the song or co-written the song with someone, and then we've brought it in, we've played it, and when we've demoed it as a band, we've recorded it, and then we've gone in with the big producer and we've tried to re-record it, and it hasn't worked, so we've just gone back to the demo. And everything that's been a hit, you know, the songs you'd think of with Race, like with some extent, no, like America, yes, Wire to Wire, yes, Golden Touch, yes, you know, they're all actually the demo recordings.
What is your relationship like with those songs now? Is it as sort of private as it was when you wrote them, or does it take on a different meaning when you sort of play them and they take on their own form?
I was doing Golden Touch about a year ago, and suddenly I wrote the lyrics, but I suddenly understood them, and it was great. It's this really exciting moment.
It only took you a while, right?
Yeah, I know. But I think, I can't remember what it was, but I think actually there's two ways of reading the chorus. The chorus could mean two different things. And I'd only ever meant it the way I wrote it. And I heard it while I was singing it. And I thought, oh, yeah, it could mean it that way around. Oh, it can mean that as well. And I was so thrilled. I was like, oh, yeah, great.
It's crazy. I think it takes certain, like with me, certain songs you only understand when you're a little bit older. Like for some reason, I keep hearing Bohemian Like You by the Dandy Warhols, and I've only started to get it for the first time, but what it's about.
Because when that came out, I don't know if you're a bit younger than me, but I remember it came out and it was like, I was kind of like, I thought it was just a bit obvious. Bohemian, everyone's Bohemian, whatever. Right, and I just thought it was a bit too obvious for a song title, and then actually it was in my head the other day, and I was thinking it's brilliant, and the lyrics just perfect.
Did you ever watch the documentary Dig that was about them and the Brian's Jonestown massacre?
Yeah,
it's one of the craziest documentaries, probably my favorite. I'd say it's top five favorite music documentaries of all time. Like it's allured me to Anton so much that I just think he's an absolute force of nature.
I really enjoyed it, but I came out with the opposite feeling.
Did you?
Yeah.
Maybe this is why I like enjoy interviewing people. Like I like really enjoy just like people with different personalities.
No, do you know what? I watched it, and I think I might have veered on the allured side, as you say, for a little bit, and then I think as time went on, I was like, hang on. There's a lot of spin here, isn't there? As I start to understand more what happens in music, I think.
There's a question I got asked because I had Pete Doherty on the podcast a while back, about a year ago actually, and we were talking about your sort of your early run with the Libertines, and I wasn't quite sure whether this is fact. I mean, I feel like I can confirm it now because I've got two different views on it. But he said that the reason that you didn't stay on in the band is that they had to play a gig to the Rough Trade label that was coming to see them. But you decided you were going to stay in Cardiff and party with a band. And I can't remember the band off the top of my head.
Well, that's almost true. I was, it probably is. Let me think about this. I want to be really, really accurate. I was on tour with the Alabama Three.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, and I had I'd never planned to play in the Libertines for long. Mm-hmm. I loved the band, and they were like, you know, my friends. You know, we were sort of a gang of very close friends, and I really loved what they were doing. But I always wanted to do my own thing. And John, who was a big friend of mine, we were like heroin buddies in the 90s, and we'd known each other for a long time. He'd said to me, look, I think the band isn't going anywhere. Peter and Carlos are like, they're kind of losing it. And, what should I do? I don't really feel like doing the band anymore. And I was like, well, just do whatever you want to do. And he was like, and he left the band. And then, I was off doing other stuff. And then they had like a gig that was suddenly really, really important. And they were like, well, can you just come in and play bass? And I was like, and Gary had come in on drums. And I said, yeah, I'll come in and fill in for a couple of gigs, right? But, John left the band and he's my mate and I'm not going to, do you know what I mean? I'm not going to do it long term, But Peter had this, it's all linked because Peter had gone and seen the Strokes and he'd decided that the way he was going to make it was to try and get.
From what he told me, he sold them acid.
He might have done, but the thing he got from it, this is when he got Steve to sing in the band, but he thought if he gets all his best looking friends in a band, then it would be more like the Strokes. So that was kind of the game plan.
That's canny. It is canny.
Yeah. But that didn't quite, it didn't work out. It didn't pan out that way. But anyway, I wasn't up John because he'd kind of left the band and he was my mate as well, so I was like, look, I'll come and I'll do a couple of gigs. And then I'd got a gig. I was really, really into I was doing my own thing where I felt like I sort of felt like Leadbelly and the Clash were the same thing,
yeah,
but no one else in the world understood that. Mm-hmm. So I was doing these shows on my own that were kind of like punk gospel, I don't know, blues, I don't really know how to put it. And I was getting pretty good at that. And then out of the blue, what's his what's his name? Rob Sprague from Alabama, the Reverend Larry Love, as he's known. So was he Larry Love anyway? Yeah, he was. And he came and saw me play, and he said, "Fucking right, boyo, let's come on tour and fucking do Lead Belly. I've got a fucking gospel choir, fucking mint." And I was like, "That's my best impression, by the way." And I was like, "What do you mean?" He was like, "Well, we want you to come on stage and at the end of our show and play the Midnight Special. We've got this gospel choir and they're going to sing it along with you. Come and do it on tour every night."
Wow.
And I was like, "Yeah, man." So I went off to do that, you know, and I was getting paid in coke, which was kind of like, I mean, you know, I was a heroin addict from the age of 16 to 20. So by the time I was 21, 22 by then. So I didn't have that much interest in coke or drugs in general, because I'd kind of done my time and moved through it.
Could you not have asked them for the monetary equivalent?
I didn't even mention money. You know, I was just so pleased to be doing it, you know?
Yeah.
I just, and it, what, but as it transpired, they just kept giving me a bag of coke after every gig. So whether it was an official payment or not, I don't know. But yeah, and then it was great. And then, yeah, I knew that there was this rough trade gig coming up. So I went to a payphone and I called Carl and I said, "Listen, I'm really sorry. I'm out on tour with the Alabamas. I'm in Cardiff and I can't make the gig, you know, let me know if that's a big problem." Well, I just felt like it was kind of like a thing, you know, like I said, I was going to come in and dep in the band
for
a couple of gigs. Do you know what I mean? And then I was out on the road sort of with an opportunity concerning my own career, you know, because it wasn't like I was going to do the Libertines thing long term, you know?
I want to come back to the fact that you were such a Clash fan, because like surely it must have made you jealous that they did their debut album with Mick Jones. But like the question I kind of want to ask you before that is, how do you get addicted to heroin at 16? I come from like a small place in Northern Ireland, like very provincial.
Well, you know, Belfast is the best place in the world to clean up. And that's what I did actually when I was 20. Yeah, I had a girlfriend from Donegal D, up the coast. Yeah, and we went out there. Anyway, it's a long story. But how do you get hooked? You just keep
Is it because? I'm only asking just simply due to the fact because, like, you know, being 16 and from Oma, where I'm from, is very different to being 16 from London. Like, was it because you were out at club nights and running around with the Libertines and people like that, or?
No, it was a long time before the Libertines. When I met Pete, well, no, maybe not that long, but I met Pete when I was about 18, and me and John were both heroin addicts, and Peter had a duffel coat and a bicycle and listened to Belle and Sebastian. And he was very shocked by the drug use, and he was like, he'd be like, "Man, you don't need to do that. Don't do that." It was. He had a sort of wide-eyed innocence about him that was very endearing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of. It was more like. It was more like the. I don't know. There was a kind of scene in Camden, you know, and first I don't know. I got into, you know, I got into LSD because I was always with the Eco Warriors squats and that kind of stuff. And, you know, that was where I'd run away from home to go and hang out there, and there was a lot of acid, so I got into that, and then I got into Speed or whatever, and then, you know, because that was just around in Camden, and then after a while it sort of became a bit, and then it, you know, Ease and stuff, but it sort of became a stigma because we started to feel like all those drugs were hippie drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe not Speed, but so it was like we sort of wanted, might even have been an image thing, that we wanted to like graduate to a drug that suited our image more, and you know, heroin seemed to fit the ticket. You know, and that was about right for the first two times you take it. And after that, you don't really have too much choice. You're taking it because you just want to take it, because nothing else has any allure at that point.
It must have been crazy for your mom and stuff like that. Like, they must have been like, "What the fuck do we do?" Because you're at 16, you're at that sort of age where you can kind of go and do your own thing, even though you're not an adult.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of pretty determined to get out of living at home as quickly as I could, you know, like, so I did, really, you know. So I don't think, you know, my mum just knew I was sort of somewhere trying to make it in music, you know, and that was kind of what I was doing, really, you know.
So with...
But the other thing is, you know, you can be fairly functional for a couple of years. It's not like everyone knows that's what you're doing, mm-hmm. you know.
When did Razorlight start?
Well, yeah. So actually, coming back to, I'm in a payphone booth in the parking lot in Cardiff, calling up Carl. And I wouldn't say I was jealous in any way that Mick Jones was producing their album. I was really excited, you know, because you've got to understand, it wasn't like, for me, it wasn't a competition. It was like, here's a, you know, these are my friends, you know, this is my, you know, you think about who were your best mates when you were 19, that sort of circle of friends you had, that's what it was, you know, including Mairead as well, who went on to manage Florence and the Machine. And it was kind of like, wow, Mick Jones is in our gang. Do you know what I mean? He's deigning to come and like hang out with like, you know, my friend circle. That's pretty cool. And I remember going down to Rack a few times and hanging out and stuff, you know, while they were doing the album and contributing in whatever way I did, which I can't completely remember. And it was great. It was exciting, man. It was super exciting.
Did you?
And
Did you ever have any dealings with Joe Strummer?
No.
I'd love to have met Joe Strummer and John Peel. Yeah. They're like top of my lists of people.
I never did. And then, I feel disappointed that I never did, for sure. And then what happened? Well, that week where the Libs played Rough Trade was quite a crazy week for me as well. I was going through some crazy personal stuff with a girlfriend and stuff. And there was also, and then shortly after that, I had a bunch of friends who were all in a band. They were about 19, 20. And it was a four piece, and three of them died in a car crash. And one of them was a really close friend of mine. And that was 2001, December 2001. And it was a real shock, you know? So I kind of like, I don't know, that was a real moment for me. I was living upstairs from this pub venue that I was working in. And I just thought, okay, instead of, I don't know where my friends are, but I know that the only thing they wanted to do was make music. And I don't know if they can make music anymore. Yeah. So I'm going to spend every hour of every day making music and writing the best music I can make. Like, I'm not fucking around anymore. That was like the end of being like, I was attempting to be a kind of like Warholian, scuzzy, cool guy drug addict, you know, and, you know, who had a couple of tunes. And when we went to rehearse with our band, we stole equipment and sold it for drugs rather than actually played any songs, you know. And that's what I was attempting to be. And it was like, okay, well, that's the end of that game, you know. And I really thought, like, just constantly thinking about my friends, and the songwriter in the band was immensely talented, and you know, he'd have made a huge success of his music because he was just brilliant. And you know, to that end, it was just a constant inspiration, and that was the start of me forming Razorlight, really. And also, you know, it was like, you know, Peter and Carlos, they were blazing a trail for me in a way, because it was like, they were showing that it could be done, you know? Not that the Libertine story was like from zero to hero immediately, because it certainly wasn't, you know, it took longer than people think.
Yeah, it did. It did. I remember it took a while.
It wasn't until he was, you know, with Kate in the tabloids that it kind of went mainstream from what I saw, you know. Until then, it was what it was, which was, you know, it was a great thing. I mean, I remember watching them supporting Morrissey at the Forum or Brixton or something like that, probably Brixton. And it was like me and Mairead dancing in the crowd and no one else. You know, I mean, we were the only people that knew the stuff, you know. But
whereas, like, with Razorlight, you guys, it did happen quite quickly. It happened a lot quicker for you guys than it did then.
I don't know. I'm not sure, because
This is just my opinion on the outside.
Yeah, it certainly did, yeah, because... Yeah, the Libertines, they formed in like 1998, you know. But in a way, I'd been playing alongside them from that time as well. And I saw Razorlight as sort of the fruition of what I'd been doing. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But from the moment I got that lineup together for Razorlight, it was, it did come together pretty quickly. It was, it was a sort of crazy 4 or 5 years where just everything fell in the right place at the right time, you know?
I always think that, you know, that you're in the sort of Champions League of bands when your song becomes a mainstay at an indie disco while the indie disco is happening, because it's very, when you go to an indie disco.
Yeah, me too, but have we ever had that? I don't know. Which one's our mainstay?
Well, I mean, I used to DJ indie discos all the time. I used to go to them all the time as well. I would say probably Golden Touch, like, was the one that.
All right, then I'm played. Pleased. If that has happened, I'm so pleased.
That does happen.
You're absolutely right. There's no more, you can't be more anointed than being played at the indie disco.
But it's.
I mean that. There's no irony. There's no irony in that. I really, really mean that. So if somewhere on like a Friday night there's, you know, a couple of kids who are wearing, like, a couple of boys wearing mascara, and there's Golden Touch playing on the, you know, playing through the speakers, then I'm really, really pleased.
Happy days. I mean, like, also, like, you know, you can throw on.
That's where I come from. Do you know what I mean? That was like you, I'm sure, but that's where it's from, you know. And then the thing with Razorlight that was strange, I know we're jumping about all over the place, and we haven't really talked about the demo, but it's like, I did the first album, right? Mm-hmm. As you say, Golden Touch and whatever, which for me, in a way, I sort of think of as Razorlight in some ways. And then our drummer left the band and Andy joined. And, you know, then we did the second album. And it was kind of like the second album. Andy's a great, great, great melodic harmonist. You know, he's incredible, right? And we really enjoyed writing, and it was like, all right, if it was Buzzcocks on the last one, let's go Blondie on this one, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? If it was Pixies, let's go Squeeze, you know, it was like, let's go more melodic, you know. And the thing about melody is it's so fucking seductive anyway, that once it starts pulling on you, you can't stop it, right? And I'm really proud of a lot of, like, the stuff that I was writing at that point, and the stuff that I wrote with Andy. But the thing was, I wanted to go more melodic, which in a way is going more pop, but I didn't think it was gonna work to the extent that it did. I thought, like, people, like, I thought it was gonna be like sort of slightly bubblegum in a cool way, but that wasn't what happened. It was like everyone was thinking the same thing I was thinking, and suddenly Razorlight, instead of being a band that lots of people, you know, a number of people really loved, it was a band that everybody knew about, and that's a really different thing.
Like, for a good pop record to work, is it that you write it and you have no idea, like, how it's going to go? It could not go at all. Like, it's not really in your hands anymore once it's out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my thing was, I'm rebellious by nature, right? So it was like, I'd made a good first indie record, and the one thing I didn't want to do was make a not so good second indie record. You know, make the first good indie record again, but not as good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is what I'd seen most bands do that. You know, what you can do, turn up looking a little bit harder on the cover, like wearing a leather jacket and a bit of an attitude, and like you make the, you know, that's been going on since like Pretenders 2. You know, what I mean?
You're like, yeah.
Classic. And I love Pretenders 2, by the way. You know, but not as much as I love the Pretenders. And the debut album, you know, and you know, so that was the one thing I didn't want to do. So I thought my rebellion was like, why don't I make a record that people don't expect, which I did. But it was coincidentally the record that everyone wanted to hear. I remember the editor of The Enemy at the time, Connor, he said, oh well, you've just made the record that everyone wants to hear. And I was like, I just thought to myself, like, yeah, well, if I have, like, how, it's not easy. Like, you know, try and make, you know what I mean?
It's crazy that that's
it's been not easy to make the magazine that everybody wants to fucking read. You know what I mean? It's like, so, you know, and I haven't like sat down and thought I'm going to do that. It's just, that's what's happened. You know,
I think that style of inflammatory journalism in the music press anyway, definitely doesn't really exist to the same standards now, because I think if somebody said to me going, you've made the radio show that everybody wants to hear, I'd take it as a massive compliment. I'd be like, that's brilliant.
But it was that weird backhanded thing. And that was the weird thing for, like, that was the weird thing for Razorlight, was that it, then we were kind of alienated from, you know, from from what I consider like was like our core place in the world that like I grew up in, you know what I mean? It was like, shit, like what? I'm existing in this kind of like mass appeal pop world. But I don't know, man. You know, it was like, it's the, I don't know, like, you know, I just don't know, man. But like, so when you talk about the indie disco or like the song being played, it genuinely means a lot to me, you know, because I was that kid in Camden, age 16, 17, you know what I mean? Like, you know, fucking putting it all on the line and fucking believing in music, you know?
But putting the pop record out there kind of opened you up to a whole new world, took you out of the indie disco, took you out of the 300 to 500 to 1,000 cap venues and really ridiculously scaled up, like, because you were, I mean, apart from like obviously doing your own arena tours and stuff as well, but you supported the likes of U2, Queen, The Who, Oasis, like, I mean, what?
Yeah, but a lot of that we did on our first record. By the end of the first record, we did two nights at Ali Pali, which is where I grew up as well.
So that's crazy. That's 20,000 people, isn't it?
16. Let's keep it down.
All right.
It's better to underestimate. Let's say it might be somewhere in the middle.
Mm. Then what was the biggest Razorlight show you did then?
The biggest show that we did?
Yeah.
I don't know, actually. I'm on our own?
Yeah.
I don't know. We did the O2, so that's quite big.
It's pretty big. Yeah, that's pretty big. What was it like? So like sharing stages with U2 and The Who?
Amazing, just amazing. Like, you know, you just. Oh, I could talk about Roger Daltrey a lot because.
Do you share moments with them when you're backstage? I did an interview with Simon from Biffy Clyro, and he told me how Pete Townshend had. Had to tell him to turn his guitar amp down because it was too loud. when you're with U2, are you hanging with Bono? If you're with Queen, are you talking about badger calling with Brian May? The whole thing fascinates me massively.
Yeah, I never got into anything with Brian May, unfortunately. I figured there were probably loads of topics that we could approach there. U2, I mean, for a while I was kind of part of the family there because I was dating Paul McGuinness's daughter as well, so it was kind of like, and we were going out and playing loads of shows with them, so I was quite in the scene there, and mm-hmm. that was great, you know, I mean, I was so grateful for that, and that, you know, that was very interesting. I just talked to Bono about songs, you know. I'd just be like, well, when you were coming in to think, when you're coming in with this song, did you think it needed a bridge? And then why do you think it needed a bridge? Were you sure? You know, that kind of stuff, you know, because they definitely wrote some real bangers, you mm-hmm. know. And I don't know, for me it was the great privilege I really feel that I've had in terms of that kind of thing is working with people from, well, people who were obviously heroes of mine growing up, but especially people who, from the 60s, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that was an era where, oh man, I would have liked to have been around then, because, you know, I think it was a lot more suited to how I approach things. And, you know, the people that I've worked with who were working back then, we seemed to really click and understand, you know. And the other thing was asking for advice, you know. I mean, like Roger was... I mean, oh, I don't know. It's a vignette, you know. I was sitting at home, and the landline rang. I mentioned before, I do like the landline.
I heard it go off earlier.
The landline rang, and I picked it up, and it's this guy goes, "Oh, is that Johnny?" I'm like, "Yeah, yeah." And he's like, "Oh, it's Roger Daltrey." I was like, "Yeah, fuck off." He's like, "No, it is." And I was like, "What?" And he's like, "Do you want to do the Camden, Teenage Cancer Trust at the Albert Hall?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, of course, you know." And he's like, "Look, come on, I'll sing Summertime Blues for you, and then you do like a bunch of your own songs. Yeah, sound good?" I was like, "Yeah, great." He's like, "All right, it's on the 14th of June or whatever it was." And I was like, "Well, yeah, man, sounds great. Like, let me just check with my manager that we're free and everything." He's like, "Look, shut up. I don't do managers. Just you in or out." And I was like, "I'm in," you know. And we did it, you know what I mean? I played with my manager. I was like, "By the way, we're doing a gig on the 14th of June with Roger Daltrey." He's like, "Oh, excellent," you know. And I really appreciate that, you know, I had a similar phone call from Ray Davies, you know, who was a massive hero of mine because I grew up in Muswell Hill, you know, so.
Of course.
And Ray just phoned me up similarly. I was so hungover. You know those hangovers where, like, you just, like, you're not even sweating it out of every pore. It's just like, oh, I don't know. You just can't even hold your head straight.
Yeah.
He phoned me up out of the blue and he's like, all right, Johnny, it's Ray. We've got, I've got Elvis Costello in the studio at the moment and we're just re-recording some of my old songs. Do you want to come down and play some guitar?
Not that sort of hyper.
It's like, fuck off. I just hung up. And then he phones back. He's like, Johnny. I was like, we'd never met. And I was like, yeah, I'd love to. I'll be there in like 5 minutes.
How did it turn out?
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, you know, I wasn't giving my best performance, but I like to think that I had I was in shape enough that it kind of worked out, you know?
Wow.
Elvis had left the building by the time I got there, and it's very rare you get to say that in life. So.
maybe it's for the best.
But yeah, you know, but I really liked that attitude, you know? And or like working with like David Bailey, you know, photos, and I just loved it, you know, just very straightforward and kind of the opposite of what we do now, you know.
Do you have a creative outlook? Or sorry, do you have a creative outlet outside of music? Like, do you paint or write or?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I do all kinds of things, but I kind of keep them to myself because I kind of like. I don't want them to have to go through the birth pangs of connecting with the square world, you know. Because that is a funny thing. You make a band, you know what I mean? You don't make a band to be like, and going back to the Libertines or whatever, like, you know, when we were all playing together, we were just our own scene. We didn't read The Enemy, we didn't listen to the radio, couldn't care less. You're not really thinking, let's make a band that connects with everybody. You know, because bands don't really connect with everybody. Do you know what I mean? The rock and roll ethos is not the ethos of the Daily Mail or the Sun. Are those the two leading selling newspapers in our country?
Yeah, I think
something
so.
Like that, right? Is that right?
Anyway, I have no idea. I can't remember the last time I picked up a paper.
Let's take that as representative of the viewpoint of, you know, of the majority of people. Now, the ethos of rock and roll doesn't fit with that at all. And the weird thing is, once your band becomes successful, you end up sitting down with all these journalists who start, not a conversation like this. I really, as far as music interviews go, it's been a great experience because I can tell that you care about music and you want to talk about music. And that's so, so rare. I would say it's like, it's one in hundreds that you ever get an interview like that. And, you know, what they want to do, especially in this country, is they want to talk to you about, you know, they want to do that kind of shock horror thing, you know, and try and fit you into their sort of parochial, myopic view of the world.
Yeah, like
it doesn't really fit, you know.
I'm not interested in particular clickbait or whatever. This is why the podcast.
No, exactly, and I can see that. But that's what I'm saying. It is, you know, it's a real exception to get an interview like the one that we're having right now. Actually feels like a conversation that you know, where I am, where we can, and I can get across some things that I have seen about music and certain things that I think about music and the whole thing, you know.
Where are you taking your music?
So I'm grateful. That's me saying I'm grateful.
Thanks, man. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Where are you taking your music now? Like what if because obviously your influences change over time. My influences have changed over time. I never thought I'd be into dance music when I was a teenager because I used to be I used to be 18, 19 at coming home from a rave and I'd be sticking on indie records and I'd be getting kicked off it and thrown out of the house and playing Tiësto. Yeah, and now I'm a little bit older and I'm sort of enjoying little bits of dance music and I'm enjoying little bits of jazz and all sorts of stuff. Like my music taste has changed quite a lot. What about yours? Like,
I mean, I've always listened to everything, like everything. I mean, if I look at what is here by the player right now is, it's quite rock actually. We've got Velvet Underground, White Light, White Heat. We've got PJ Harvey 4-track demos. I think there was a bit of Mozart on last night. I was definitely, I was just laughing at the harpsichord parts because they're so funny. I don't know if this is what your listeners are into, but if you're ever listening to Mozart, it's just I'm sure they're a joke, these harpsichord parts. Anyway, listen to like Marriage of Figaro or something and just check out the harpsichord player. It's insane.
I will.
I was like pissing myself. You know when you laugh so hard that it hurts the back of your head?
Yeah.
Like that. Anyway, yeah, what else have we got? Those are the three most recent things that have been on. So I don't know. I was listening to a bit of Zimbabwean music in the other room, so I started just going through old cassettes. So I don't know. I've always listened to everything, you know? And I don't know, man.
It feels like this, the cycle's coming back around. I tend to give things a wide berth for a bit, and then the cycle comes back around, and that sort of leads into the new single of Burn Camden Burn.
Oh yeah, right, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, musically at the moment, because like Björn, our original guitar player, just came back into the band, so that's absolutely fucking amazing, right? And we're just getting on really well and playing really well, and we're super excited. So for me, I don't want to put pressure on him because I'm talking to him about it, but I'm trying to get Carl, our original bass player, back as well. But he's in retirement in Sweden, and that would be fantastic. You know, I really, really would. And so we'll see. Maybe that should go in the show because it's up to him to sort of figure out what he's doing. Just. For me, it's just reconnecting with like that original Razor Light thing, you know. You know, I just kind of, that seems fun to me, you know.
Does that mean Andy would have a place back in this lineup, or is it like sort of more first album sort of thing?
Yeah, it's probably more first album. I mean, you know, there's like there's a whole other story, but it's kind of like there's like addiction issues and stuff there, which make it really hard for us to work, you know, with various people. So that's kind of like, that's not on the table for the moment.
Okay.
With all the best will in the world.
You know? Yeah.
And Burn Camden Burn was actually something that I recorded about 8-9 years ago, and the TV show just heard it, and they were like, this is perfect. Can we have it in our first episode? I was like, yeah, sure. So it's now in the virtual world. But I'm pleased that it's out there, because there's shitloads of songs like that are just sitting on a hard drive, you know? And it's like, I'm glad if they're good enough for people to enjoy, you know?
Will it make
me a bit anxious. I'm kind of like, maybe I should put out all the other stuff.
will it make an album? Like, what are you thinking? Like, is there going to be a project to work?
Yeah, well, there's definitely an album coming. We'd already started recording, and then the producer we were working with is his wife had got the COVID, you know, and it was like, okay, shit. So we've stopped, and it's basically the Corona thing is kind of holding us up at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because I was really hoping to have it out, you know, to be putting new stuff out. So in a way, this single turning up, because you know, we just come off the back of we did our own tour and we did the Kaiser Chiefs tour, which was pretty amazing. So it's nice to keep the momentum up, and so I'm glad this Burn Camden Burn has come through point, because it means there's something coming out.
Otherwise
would have been something totally new.
Not for me to step in as like use my music industry instinct, but the first thing I was just thinking was like, if you want to keep momentum up, like you've got a hard drive full of stuff, you need to be dropping that stuff there. And that there's the momentum until the album comes out. Boom.
Yeah,
10%,
well,
please.
Doing it, to be honest, it's kind of like, it was really interesting going back to Vice, because I really like the 4-track. I really like the way things sound on cassette.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what? Well, hence my solo album, which was done on a 4-track cassette as well. You know, it's like, I really like that, and it was really nice sitting there and going back to hearing those things. So, yeah, I'm definitely going to go through it and put down some mixes and stuff of the stuff that's there, and we'll see. I don't know, maybe what do you do? Just fling it out on Instagram? is that fine?
Stick it up on Spotify and let it do its thing.
Yeah, maybe I'll just make like a compilation.
Yeah.
Of like the four track stuff. It could be quite good. Because I love demos. And that was the other thing. It's like, I really like the idea of your show because I love demos.
Yeah, same.
Like I said, I tend to use them instead of the actual recordings in my music as much as possible. But I just love demos. And in fact, I don't really like the way that people make records or have made records in the last 20 years, most people. I would actually, of any artist that I like, if I think about any songwriter that I like, I think I'd rather hear their demos than their albums
mm-hmm.
from the last 20 years.
Yeah, there's something about the scratchy lo-fi-ness of music that I really enjoy. Like
overwork it, you know?
Yeah.
And people on the computer, you know, you've been in a band, right? People just pull the drums, you know, left and right, move the kick drum, get it in time. It's shit. It doesn't sound real.
There's something about like I always quite enjoyed like Moldy Peaches music and Daniel Johnson and like that sort of almost
well we got lo-fi. Adam did the intro for he wrote a skit for our fourth Wasteland album, the one we put out last year, which was pretty funny. My American friends are always really confused because I always say that Adam's the only living American genius and they look at me like Adam Green. I'm like, yeah.
I agree.
Have you not seen Aladdin?
Big time. Johnny, thanks for the demo of Vice and thanks for taking the time to chat to me.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With ACAST, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with ACAST. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.